So I'm Barry Hurlburt. I've been with the ARS for 14 years, and like John, I've been repurposed. For the first 11 years, I worked on cyanobacteria, and for the last three, I've been working on peanut and tree nut allergies. How do you make it go? Page down. So food allergy is a serious problem in the world, and it's intensifying. These are the big eight allergens that are involved with food. There it is. Tree nuts and peanuts are unique in this category of the big eight because, unlike the other food allergens, people don't outgrow them. You may become allergic to shellfish as a young child, but you'll outgrow it by your teens. Peanut and tree nut allergies are only outgrown by about 20% of the people who acquire them. So they're a lifelong problem. Inside of peanuts, there have been at least 11 well-characterized proteins that are responsible for the allergic reaction. They're called ARA-H for Arrakis hypogaea. ARA-H 1, 2, 3, and 6 are the major allergens because more than 50% of the people who have peanut allergies have IgE antibodies to them in their serum. The rest of them, are considered minor allergens. Today's talk, I will be focusing on ARA-H8, which is considered a minor allergen. It's not represented very highly in the peanut, but the interesting thing about that is it's responsible for oral allergy syndrome, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. Now, the way allergy works is you will see a protein. Your body, your immune system will see a protein, and it will elaborate IgE antibodies to that. You won't have a reaction at the first instance of seeing that allergen. Then the IgE antibodies will bind to a high affinity receptor on mast cells, and the next time you see that allergen, you will cross-link these antibodies, the antibodies here, and the receptor will elicit a signal transduction pathway, and you'll get the release of histamines and all the other chemicals that are responsible for the allergic reaction. Okay? Now remember, you have to see it first to wake up your immune system, and then when you see it again, you can have the immune response. Okay, so ARA-H8, I told you, is a minor allergen. It's not very abundant, but it's evolved in this phenomenon called oral allergy syndrome. And what makes that, what fascinated me about that and why I went after this particular protein is because you can eat a peanut or you can eat some kind of fruit and have allergic reaction even though you've never seen it before. Now, I just told you that you have to see it before you have the allergic reaction. So the way that happens is people can become allergic to pollen, oak pollen, birch pollen, hazelnut pollen, and then they can eat fruit from the Rosaceae family, or peanuts, or soy, and have a reaction to it even though they've never seen it before. Now, these reactions don't happen to be usually not as intense as a primary food reaction, which can involve anaphylaxis and death. Sometimes you can have anaphylaxis with oral allergy syndrome. Now, BetV1 is the paradigm in this category. It's been characterized to death for about three decades. It's a birch pollen thing. It makes a lot of people in northern United States and in Europe allergic. But my favorite protein, ARA-H8, is only 45% identical at the sequence level. Native and recombinant forms have been shown to react with IgEs that are involved in binding BetV1. And so what we wanted to do was clone, express, and purify the protein, determine a three-dimensional structure of it, find out what kind of purpose it may have in a peanut, what it's doing there in the first place, and do some epitope mapping studies to find out what the IgE antibodies are binding to towards making perhaps a hypoallergenic part of the protein that could be used in immunotherapy. So I'm going to walk you through what we've done. We did clone, express, and purify the protein. We have a collaborator who was at the University of Virginia, who's now at South Carolina. He's a crystallographer, and he solved the three-dimensional structure of it using X-ray crystallography. And here's our protein. It's a really small protein. It's only 17 kilodaltons. This is looking at it from three different sides. It's got a set of beta strands on one side and three helices, one big long one laying across it. It's kind of like holding a baseball bat in a glove. And there's a big pocket in here that I'll show you a little bit more about later. Now, if we take the structure of BET V1, which has been solved 20 years ago, and overlay it with ARGI, even though it's 45% identical at the amino acid level, which is not very much, the structures are almost perfectly identical. And hence, there's a reason you could have this oral allergy syndrome reaction with peanut by virtue of binding antibodies to BET V1 to our ARAH8 guy. Now, I mentioned that this reaction happens with peanuts, soy, and rosacea family. And if you take some members of those and line up, where's my arrow? Line up the amino acids here, you find that there are some highly conserved residues. And if you map those residues onto the three-dimensional structure, you see that they're mostly on the outside of the thing. So they're going to be exposed to the immune system, not buried inside. Probably the guys that are responsible for the cross-reactivity. Now, we move on to what is this guy doing, what is our protein doing in peanuts? It is very similar structure to this human protein that binds cholesterol. The start domain of this MLN64 guy looks a lot like BET-V1, looks a lot like ARAH8, and it binds cholesterol. So we went and looked at ligands that would bind to it. Here is the hydrophobic pocket, and where's this thing? Sucks. There. There's a big hydrophobic pocket between that big helix I was talking about and the beta strands. And so we devised an assay to look at compounds that would bind. ANS, with this long old name here, has been long known to bind to hydrophobic regions of proteins. It was originally used to look at molten globules, which are proteins that are folded inside out. So it'll bind to hydrophobic regions. And what we did is we would bind ANS. We'd take our protein at about 40 micromolar, and we bind ANS to it, and we'd see an increase in fluorescence as we increase the ANS. And then we would add back to it a compound, say, apigenin. We tested a lot of them. I'll show you those in a second. And we would see ANS fluorescence go down. That means that the apigenin is binding where the ANS is and displacing it. It's knocking it out of the pocket and you're losing the fluorescence. Now, in an unexpected result, other compounds like daidzine over here, we take our protein by itself, we bind ANS to it, and the fluorescence would go up, and then we added back to it more and more of this compound, the fluorescence increased. So it is binding in the same pocket, not displacing the ANS, and having a quantum yield increase in the fluorescence by kind of sandwiching it. So the ANS fluorescence is going up when this guy binds, so they're both in there. Now, if you take all the compounds that we looked at, these are the ones that change fluorescence. Some of them increase fluorescence. This is the maximum fluorescence when you had ANS in our protein before you added the competitor. Some of them would go up, like the diazine I showed you. Some would go down. Some went really down. They're really nice competitors. They're bound tightly. And these are the compounds that we tested. All these guys up here caused a change. They bound into that pocket. All these guys we tested had no effect on the ANS fluorescence. We also tried a compound that has gotten a lot of popular... Oh, sorry. Here's a picture of some of the compounds that were bound because our collaborator in South Carolina has solved the structures of them with these ligands in there, showing where they bind. We also tested this compound. It's got a lot of popular literature because it had effects on aging and cancer and heart and all kinds of stuff. So we tried to do the ANS displacement assay with that, but it turns out that resveratrol fluoresces on its own. So we just left the ANS out. Here's our protein by itself. When we add resveratrol to it, it's binding in the pocket, and the fluorescence is going up. It's a nice little marker, just like ANS. So it binds in there, too. So what we're thinking is that this protein is involved with signaling during germination of a peanut seed, and it's carrying these molecules that could be released upon germination and cause some kind of developmental activity going on. In addition, I didn't mention it at the beginning, but I say PR10 protein down here. PR10 stands for pathogenesis related, and there's at least 10 classes of them, and this BETV1 and ARA-H8 and all the other ones fall into that category, so that if a plant is attacked by a fungus or a bacterium or incurs some kind of damage, these proteins are upregulated, and resveratrol is also upregulated. Okay. Now we have a structure of it, we have a potential function for it, and we're interested in allergies. So between my colleague Sohaila Maliki and I, we are doing this microchip analysis to determine the epitopes of all the peanut protein allergens, all the walnut allergens, all the 2S albumins in fruit and nuts that are involved with allergy, all the nonspecific lipid transfer proteins that are involved with allergy, all the proteins involved with PR10 proteins that I was just talking about. And then we also have a side project where we're trying to be able to predict the IgE epitopes on proteins. So we have computationally predicted ones that we've got stuck on this microchip here. There are about 2,000 different peptides on each one of these microchips. And we're looking for IgE binding. This is a zoom in on it. They're only 15 amino acids long. And the way we did it with, for an example, my protein ARA-H8, is we start at the N-terminus. This is the protein here, linear amino acid sequence. We would make a 15-mer peptide. We'd print that on the microchip. We'd move over 5 amino acids, make the next 15-mer amino acid, print that on the microchip. Move over another 5, print that on the microchip. So we have a stair step of these peptides marching across the protein in triplicate on each one of these microchips. And what we do is take clinically characterized patient serum, allergic patients that have been food challenged and react, and put them on these slides, and then we detect the IgE binding with a green fluorescent dye and the IgG4, which is an antibody that's thought to compete with IgE for allergens, with a red fluorescent dye. And when you do, we've done about 200 different patients right now, and this is a, you don't need to try to digest this, but this is number of patients across here. These are the peptides across this axis, and then this is signal-to-noise ratio. What we've done is taken the signal from one of these peptides, from one of the spots. We have a laser scanner that does it and spits out more data than you want to think about. Take the spot and take the background around it and the intensity in it and use that as a signal-to-noise ratio, okay? And we arbitrarily determined that 3 was going to be our cutoff, and this is going up to 40. So we can find that, say, these peptides at the N-terminus are really reactive. These guys down here are not very reactive. So we're mapping the epitopes on the protein. And we can go back to the three-dimensional structure, and what I've shown in the background is the backbone is in green, and then the top three epitopes are shown in cyan, blue, gold here for IgE binding. This is just two sides of the protein. If you take the protein and flip it around the other side, you see this a lot better. This is for IgE binding. This is for the IgG4 binding. Now, allergy community thinks that there's a competition between IgE and IgG4, that if your body has more IgG4 in it, it's going to bind up all the epitopes and block IgE binding, and therefore you won't have an allergic reaction. And that's been shown in immunotherapy. If you have a patient who's allergic, who's eating small amounts of the allergen, peanuts for example, and becoming less allergic, the IgG4 antibodies go up. So we wanted to map those two. And what we find is, in some cases, the epitopes are the same, like this blue guy here, but in some cases, they're not. So this guy that's pink on the IgE is not recognized by any IgG4s in these patients. And we're doing that for all of the proteins. I mean, it's pretty massive. And so these are the people who have done the work with me. This is my group leader. It's my technician, it's her technician, and this is another one of my technicians, and these are the crystallographers now at South Carolina that did the structural work for us. And thank you for your attention.
How close are we to getting a handle on controlling serious allergies?
There was a massive study. All the patients that I showed you right here came from London, from King's College London, with a colleague named Gideon Lack and his graduate student, Alex. And they've all been food challenged and all that stuff. And they just completed this monster study called the LEAP study, where 5 years ago, they took 600 kids that were predetermined to be susceptible to be peanut allergic. They split them into two groups of 300. They gave them all food challenges at the beginning. And then they had 300 of them abstain from eating peanuts for 5 years, and 300 of them eat peanuts for 5 years. And there was a 70% difference. The ones that ate the peanuts did not become allergic. So this abstinence idea that's been promulgated in the United States and in Europe for decades is a bad idea. Now that's one way to start dealing with the problem. Give your kids peanuts. Feed them. The other thing that is going on right now that's showing some promise, there's a peanut patch with a slow release that's being marketed out of France. And there's oral immunotherapy that's being done too. Sublingual oral immunotherapy. You put it in your mouth, under your tongue. Increase the dose. Now, the data on that's a little sketchy. It doesn't seem to hold with a lot of the kids. Some of the kids become completely peanut allergic for long periods of time. A lot of them revert when they get off of the therapy. And one of the projects that we're doing with all this epitope mapping is to be able to find the really dominant epitopes. And we can use that in two ways. One, we could make recombinant versions of it where that epitope has been mutated and no longer is reactive, and we could feed that to kids in oral immunotherapy. And the other thing is to be able to use that to identify allergens that are in food products by some kind of mass spec or DNA-based assays. So that one of the problems is cross-contamination in food production lines.
Does this breastfeeding help at all? Convince kids?
Breastfeeding per se, there's no data to support that. There was a report that Sohaila believes is erroneous that came out about 15 years ago that said that peanut proteins are transferred through breast milk to children. And she looked at it for about 10 years and could never ever find them in there. It looked hard. So they think she believes that that study was not good. You're allergic?
Yes.
Can I have some of your blood?
As long as you don't give me a peanut first.
No, we have, Sohaila is also faculty at Tulane, and she has a relationship with the blood center there, and we have a program where people we identify as being peanut or tree nut allergic can go there, donate blood for our research, get a $25 Walmart or Amazon card out of my pocket, because she's my wife. And we use your blood and characterize it. We can put it on the chips. Find out exactly what you react to.
I'll be on a chip forever.
Like your husband's gonna cry.
Any other questions?
Yeah.